Although Germany had not yet openly violated the clauses of the treaty, which forbade our military air force, civil aviation and an immense development of gliding had now reached a point where they could very rapidly reinforce and extend the secret and illegal military air force already formed. The blatant denunciations of communism and Bolshevism by Hitler had not prevented the clandestine sending by Germany of arms to Russia. On the other hand, from 1927 onwards, a number of German pilots were trained by the Soviets for military purposes. There were fluctuations, but in 1932, the British ambassador in Berlin reported that the Reichswehr had close technical liaison with the Red Army. Nevertheless, when on the 20th of July, 1934, the government brought forward some belated and inadequate proposals for strengthening the Royal Air Force by 41 squadrons, or about 820 machines, only to be completed in 5 years, the Labour Party, supported by the Liberals, moved a vote of censure upon them in the House of Commons. Mr. Attlee, speaking in their name, said, "We deny the need for increased air armaments. We deny the proposition that an increased British Air Force will make for the peace of the world, and we reject altogether the claim to parity." I now enjoyed, for once, the advantage of being able to urge rearmament in the guise of a defender of the government. I therefore received an unusually friendly hearing from the Conservative Party. I do not suppose there has ever been such a pacifist-minded government. There is the Prime Minister, who in the war proved in the most extreme manner and with very great courage his convictions and the sacrifices he would make for what he believed was the cause of pacifism. The Lord President of the Council is chiefly associated in the public mind with the repetition of the prayer, "Give peace in our time." One would have supposed that when ministers like these come forward and say that they feel it their duty to ask for some small increase in the means they have of guaranteeing the public safety, it would weigh with the opposition and would be considered as a proof of the reality of the danger from which they seek to protect us. Then look at the apologies which the government have made. No one could have put forward a proposal in more extremely inoffensive terms. Meekness has characterized every word which they have spoken since this subject was first mooted. We are told that we can see for ourselves how small is the proposal. We are assured that it can be stopped at any minute if Geneva succeeds. And we are also assured that the steps we are taking, although they may to some lower minds have associated with them some idea of national defense, are really only associated with the great principle of collective security. We are a rich and easy prey. No country is so vulnerable, and no country would better repay pillage than our own. With our enormous metropolis here, the greatest target in the world, a kind of tremendous, fat, valuable cow tied up to attract the beast of prey, we are in a position in which we have never been before, and in which no other country is at the present time. By the end of 1935, the German Air Force will be nearly equal in numbers and efficiency to our home defense air force at that date, even if the government's present proposals are carried out. The third statement is that if Germany continues this expansion, and if we continue to carry out our scheme, then, sometime in 1936, Germany will be definitely and substantially stronger in the air than Great Britain. Fourthly, and this is the point which is causing anxiety, once they have got that lead, we may never be able to overtake them. If these assertions cannot be contradicted, then there is cause for the anxiety which exists in all parts of the House, not only because of the physical strength of the German Air Force, but I am bound to say also because of the character of the present German dictatorship. If the government have to admit at any time in the next 2 years that the German air forces are stronger than our own, then they will be held, and I think rightly held, to have failed in their prime duty to the country. The Labour Party's vote of censure was of course defeated by a large majority. It would have been possible in 1933 or even in 1934 for Britain to have created an air power which would have imposed the necessary restraints upon Hitler's ambition. More than 5 whole years had yet to run before we were to be confronted with the supreme ordeal. When the winter session opened on November the 28th, 1934, I moved in the name of some of my friends an amendment to the address. Germany already, at this moment, has a military air force. That is to say, military squadrons with the necessary ground services and the necessary reserves of trained personnel and material, which only awaits an order to assemble in full open combination, and that this illegal air force is rapidly approaching equality with our own. Secondly, by this time next year, if Germany executes her existing program without acceleration, and if we execute our existing program on the basis which now lies before us without slowing down, and carry out the increases announced to Parliament in July last, the German military air force will this time next year be in fact at least as strong as our own, and it may be even stronger. Thirdly, on the same basis, that is to say, both sides continuing with their existing programs as at present arranged, by the end of 1936, that is 1 year farther on, and 2 years from now, the German military air force will be nearly 50% stronger, and in 1937 nearly double. Mr. Baldwin, who followed me at once, faced this issue squarely, and on the case made out by his air ministry advisers, met me with direct contradiction. It is not the case that Germany is rapidly approaching equality with us. I cannot look farther forward than the next 2 years. Mr. Churchill speaks of what may happen in 1937. Such investigations as I have been able to make lead me to believe that his figures are considerably exaggerated. Thus, Mr. Baldwin. This sweeping assurance from the virtual Prime Minister soothed most of the alarmed and silenced many of the critics. Everyone was glad to learn that my precise statement had been denied of an unimpeachable authority. I was not at all convinced. I believe that Mr. Baldwin was not being told the truth by his advisers, and anyhow, that he did not know the facts. However, at the end of March, the Foreign Secretary, Mr. Eden, paid a visit to Herr Hitler in Germany, and in the course of an important conversation, the text of which is on record, they were told personally by him that the German Air Force had already reached parity with Great Britain. This fact was made public by the government on April the 3rd. At the beginning of May, the Prime Minister wrote an article in his own organ, the Newsletter, which he emphasized the dangers of German rearmament in terms akin to those I had so often expressed since 1932. He used the revealing word ambush, which must have sprung from the anxiety of his heart. We had indeed fallen into an ambush. When in due course I was called in the debate, I said, the government have proposed these increases. They must face the storm. They will have to encounter every form of unfair attack. Their motives will be misrepresented. They will be calumniated and called warmongers. Every kind of attack will be made upon them by many powerful, numerous, and extremely vocal forces in this country. They are going to get it anyway. Why then not fight for something that will give us safety? Why then not insist that the provision for the Air Force should be adequate? Why then, however severe may be the censure, and ever strident the abuse which they have to face, at any rate, there will be this satisfactory result that His Majesty's government will be able to feel that in this, of all matters, the prime responsibility of a government, they have done their duty. Although the House listened to me with close attention, I felt a sensation of despair. To be so entirely convinced and vindicated in a matter of life and death to one's country, and not to be able to make Parliament and the nation heed the warning or bow to the proof by taking action, was an experience most painful. I went on. I confess that words fail me. In the year 1708, Mr. Secretary St. John, by a calculated ministerial indiscretion, revealed to the House the fact that the Battle of Almanza had been lost in the previous summer, because only 8,000 English troops were actually in Spain out of the 29,000 that had been voted by the House of Commons for this service. When a month later this revelation was confirmed by the government, It is recorded that the house sat in silence for half an hour. And yet how incomparably small that event was to what we have now to face. There lay in my memory at this time some lines from an unknown writer about a railway accident. I had learned them from a volume of Punch cartoons, which I used to pore over when I was 8 or 9 years old at school at Brighton. Who is in charge of the clattering train? The axles creak and the couplings strain, and the pace is hot and the points are near, and sleep hath deadened the driver here, and the signals flash through the night in vain, for death is in charge of the clattering train. It was not until May the 22nd that Mr. Baldwin made his celebrated confession. I'm forced to cite it. Here's what he said. First of all, with regard to the figure I gave in November of German aeroplanes, nothing has come to my knowledge since that makes me think that figure was wrong. I believed at that time it was right. Where I was wrong was in my estimate of the future. There I was completely wrong. We were completely misled on that subject. I think it is only due to say that there has been a great deal of criticism, both in the press and verbally, about the Air Ministry, as though they were responsible for possibly an inadequate program. I only want to repeat that whatever responsibility there may be, that responsibility is not that of any single minister. It is the responsibility of the government as a whole. And we are all responsible, and we are all to blame. I hope that this shocking confession would be a decisive event, and that at least a parliamentary committee of all parties would be set up to report upon the facts and upon our safety. The House of Commons had a different reaction. The Labour and Liberal oppositions, having 9 months earlier moved or supported a vote of censure, even upon the most modest steps the government had taken, were ineffectual and undecided. They were looking forward to an election against Tory armaments. Neither the Labour nor the Liberal spokesmen had prepared themselves for Mr. Baldwin's disclosure and admission, and they did not attempt to adapt their speeches to this outstanding episode. The government majority, for their part, appeared captivated by Mr. Baldwin's candour. His admission of having been utterly wrong, with all his sources of knowledge upon a vital matter for which he was responsible, was held to be redeemed by the frankness with which he had declared his error and shouldered the blame. There was even a strange wave of enthusiasm for a minister who did not hesitate to say he was wrong. Indeed, many Conservative members seemed angry with me for having brought their trusted leader to a plight from which only his native manliness and honesty had extricated him, but not, alas, his country. A disaster of the first magnitude had fallen upon us. Hitler had already obtained parity with Great Britain. Henceforward, he had merely to drive his factories and training schools at full speed, not only to keep his lead in the air, but steadily to improve it. Very considerable efforts were made by the British government in the next 4 years, and there was no doubt that we excelled in air quality, but quantity was henceforth beyond us. The outbreak of the war found us with barely half the German numbers.
16th of November, 1934. Extracts from a radio broadcast, The Causes of War.
I have such a short time to deal with this enormous subject. And I beg you, therefore, to weigh my words with the attention and thought which I have given to them. Many people think that the best way to escape war is to dwell upon its horrors and to imprint them vividly upon the minds of the younger generation. They flaunt the grisly photographs before their eyes. They fill their ears with tales of carnage. They dilate upon the ineptitude of generals and admirals. They denounce the crime and insensate folly of human strife. Now, all this teaching ought to be very useful in preventing us from attacking or invading any other country, if anyone outside a madhouse wished to do so. But how would it help us if we were attacked or invaded ourselves? That is the question we have to ask. Would the invaders consent to visit Lord Beaverbrook's exhibition or listen to the impassioned appeals of Mr. Lloyd George? Would they agree to meet that famous South African, General Smuts, and have their inferiority complex removed in friendly, reasonable debate? I doubt it. I have borne responsibility for the safety of this country in grievous times. I gravely doubt it. But even if they did, I am not so sure we should convince them and persuade them to go back quietly home. They might say, it seems to me, you are rich, we are poor, you seem well fed, we are hungry. You have been victorious, we have been defeated. You have valuable colonies, we have none. You have your navy, where is ours? You have had the past, let us have the future. Above all, I fear, they would say, you are weak and we are strong. There are those who say, let us ignore the continent of Europe. Let us leave it with its hatreds and its armaments to stew in its own juice, to fight out its own quarrels and dree its own doom. Let us turn our backs upon this melancholy and alarming scene. Let us fix our gaze across the oceans and lead our own life in the midst of our peace-loving dominions and empires. Now, there would be much to be said for this plan if only we could unfasten the British islands from their rock foundations and could tow them 3,000 miles across the Atlantic Ocean and could anchor them safely upon the smiling coasts of Canada. Well, I have not yet heard of any way in which this could be done. No engineer has come forward with any scheme. Even our best scientists are done. It would certainly, in any case, take a long time. Have we got a long time? At present, we lie within a few...
The Loaded Pause. A speech to the Conservative Members' Committee on Foreign Affairs, March 1936.
For 400 years... the foreign policy of England has been to oppose the strongest, most aggressive, most dominating power on the continent, and particularly to prevent the Low Countries falling into the hands of such a power. Viewed in the light of history, these 4 centuries of consistent purpose amid so many changes of name and fact, of circumstances and conditions, must rank as one of the most remarkable episodes which the records of any race, nation, state, or people can show. Observe that the policy of England takes no account of which nation it is that seeks the overlordship of Europe. The question is not whether it is Spain or the French monarchy or the French Empire or the German Empire or the Hitler regime. It has nothing to do with rulers or nations. It is concerned solely with whoever is the strongest or the potentially dominating tyrant. Therefore, we should not be afraid of being accused of being pro-French or anti-German. If the circumstances were reversed, we could equally be pro-German and anti-French. It is a law of public policy which we are following, and not a mere expedient dictated by accidental circumstances or likes and dislikes or any other sentiment. The question therefore arises, which is today the power in Europe, which is the strongest, and which seeks in a dangerous and oppressive sense to dominate? Today, for this year, probably for part of 1937, the French army is the strongest in Europe. But no one is afraid of France. Everyone knows that France wants to be let alone, and that with her it is only a case of self-preservation. Everyone knows that the French are peaceful and overhung by fear. They are at once brave, resolute, peace-loving, and weighed down by anxiety. They are a liberal nation with free parliamentary institutions. Germany, on the other hand, she has no one. She is arming in a manner which has never been seen in German history. She is led by a handful of triumphant desperados. Their money is running short. Discontents are arising beneath these despotic rulers. Very soon they will have to choose, on the one hand, between economic and financial collapse or internal upheaval, and on the other, a war which could have no other object, and which, if successful, can have no other result than a Germanized Europe under Nazi control. Therefore, it seems to me that all the old conditions present themselves again, and that our national salvation depends upon our gathering once again all the forces of Europe to contain, to restrain, and if necessary, to frustrate German domination. For believe me, if any of those...
Winston Churchill's speech continued.
First, we ought to count our effective association with France. That does not mean that we should develop a needlessly hostile mood against Germany. It is a part of our duty and our interest to keep the temperature low between these two countries. We shall not have any difficulty in this so far as France is concerned. Like us, they are a parliamentary democracy with tremendous inhibitions against war. And like us, under considerable drawbacks in preparing their defense. Therefore, I say we ought to regard our defensive association with France as fundamental. Everything else must be viewed in proper subordination, now that the times have become so sharp and perilous. Those who are possessed of a definite body of doctrine and of deeply rooted conviction upon it will be in a much better position to deal with the shifts and surprises of daily affairs than those who are merely taking short views and indulging their natural impulses as they are evoked by what they read from day to day. The first thing is to decide where you want to go. For myself, I am for the armed league of all nations, or as many as you can get, against the potential aggressor. With England and France at the core of it, let us neglect nothing in our power to establish the great international framework. If that should prove to be beyond our strength, or if it breaks down through the weakness or wrongdoing of others, then at least let us make sure that England and France, the two surviving free great countries of Europe, can together ride out any new storm that may blow, with good and reasonable hopes of once again going safely through.
We return to Chapter 12, the Second World War, The Loaded Pause.
On May the 28th, 1937, after King George VI had been crowned, Mr. Baldwin retired. His long public services were suitably rewarded by an earldom and the Garter. He departed in a glow of public gratitude and esteem. There was no doubt who his successor should be. Mr. Neville Chamberlain had, as Chancellor of the Exchequer, not only done the main work of the government for 5 years past, but was the ablest and most forceful minister with high abilities and an historic name. I had described him a year earlier at Birmingham in Shakespeare's words as the packhorse in our great affairs, and he had accepted this description as a compliment. I had no expectation that he would wish to work with me, nor would he have been wise to do so at such a time. His ideas were far different from mine on the treatment of the dominant issues of the day. But I welcomed the accession to power of a live, competent executive figure. Our relations continued to be cool, easy, and polite, both in public and in private. Mr. Chamberlain made few changes in the government. He had had disagreements with Mr. Duff Cooper about War Office administration, and much surprised him by offering him advancement to the great key office of the Admiralty. I, in my turn, was astonished that Sir Samuel Hoare, who had just secured a large expansion of the naval program, should wish to leave the Admiralty for the Home Office. Hoare seems to have believed that prison reform in a broad humanitarian sense would become the prevailing topic in the immediate future. And since his family was connected with the famous Elizabeth Fry, he had a strong personal sentiment about it. I may here set down a comparative appreciation of these two prime ministers, Baldwin and Chamberlain, whom I had known so long and under whom I had served or was to serve. Stanley Baldwin was the wiser, more comprehending personality, but without detailed executive capacity. He was largely detached from foreign and military affairs. He knew little of Europe and disliked what he knew. He had a deep knowledge of British party politics and represented in a broad way some of the strengths and many of the infirmities of our island race. He had fought 5 general elections as leader of the Conservative Party and had won 3 of them. He had a genius for waiting upon events and an imperturbability under adverse criticism. He was singularly adroit in letting events work for him and capable of seizing the right moment when it came. He seemed to me to revive the impression history gives us of Sir Robert Walpole, without, of course, the 18th century corruption. And he was master of British politics for nearly as long. Neville Chamberlain, on the other hand, was alert, businesslike, opinionated, and self-confident in a very high degree. Unlike Baldwin, he conceived himself able to comprehend the whole field of Europe and indeed the world. Instead of a vague but nonetheless deeply seated intuition, we now had a narrow, sharp-edged efficiency within the limits of the policy in which he believed. Both as Chancellor of the Exchequer and as Prime Minister, he kept the tightest and most rigid control upon military expenditure. He was, throughout this period, the masterful opponent of all emergency measures. He had formed decided judgments about all the political figures of the day, both at home and abroad, and felt himself capable of dealing with them. His all-pervading hope was to go down to history as the great peacemaker, and for this he was prepared to strive continually in the teeth of fact and face great risks for himself and his country. Unhappily, he ran into tides, the force from which he could not measure, and met hurricanes from which he did not flinch, but with which he could not cope. In these closing years before the war, I should have found it easier to work with Baldwin, as I knew him, than with Chamberlain, but neither of them had any wish to work with me, except in the last resort. One day in 1937, I had a meeting with Herr von Ribbentrop, German ambassador to Britain. In one of my fortnightly articles, I noted that he had been misrepresented in some speech he had made. I had, of course, met him several times in society. He now asked me whether I would come to see him and have a talk. He received me in the large upstairs room at the German embassy. We had a conversation lasting for more than 2 hours. Ribbentrop was most polite, and we ranged over the European scene, both in respect of armaments and policy. The gist of his statement to me was that Germany sought the friendship of England, on the continent we are still often called England. He said he could have been Foreign Minister of Germany, but he had asked Hitler to let him come over to London in order to make the full case for an Anglo-German entente or even alliance. Germany would stand guard for the British Empire with all its greatness and extent. They might ask for the return of the German colonies, but this was evidently not cardinal. What was required was that Britain should give Germany a free hand in the east of Europe. She must have her Lebensraum, or living space, for her increasing population. Therefore, Poland and the Danzig corridor must be absorbed. White Russia and the Ukraine were indispensable to the future life of the German Reich of more than 70 million souls. Nothing less would suffice. All that was asked of the British Commonwealth and Empire was not to interfere. There was a large map on the wall, and the ambassador several times led me to it to illustrate his project. After hearing all this, I said at once that I was sure the British government would not agree to give Germany a free hand in Eastern Europe. It was true we were on bad terms with Soviet Russia, and that we hated communism as much as Hitler did. But he might be sure that even if France were safeguarded, Great Britain would never disinterest herself in the fortunes of the continent, to an extent which would enable Germany to gain the domination of Central and Eastern Europe. We were actually standing before the map when I said this. Ribbentrop turned abruptly away. He then said, in that case, war is inevitable. There is no way out. The Führer is resolved. Nothing will stop him, and nothing will stop us. We then returned to our chairs. I was only a private member of Parliament, but of some prominence. I thought it right to say to the German ambassador, in fact, I remember the words well, when you talk of war, which no doubt would be general war, you must not underrate England. She is a curious country, and few foreigners can understand her mind. Do not judge by the attitude of the present administration. Once a great cause is presented to the people, all kinds of unexpected actions might be taken by this very government and by the British nation. And I repeat it, do not underrate England. She is very clever. If you plunge us all into another great war, she will bring the whole world against you, like last time. At this the ambassador rose in heat and said, ah, England may be very clever, but this time she will not bring the world against Germany. We turned the conversation onto Etienne Lines, and nothing more of note occurred. The incident, however, remains in my memory, and as I reported it at the time to the Foreign Office, I feel it right to put it on record. When he was on trial for his life by the conquerors, Ribbentrop gave a distorted version of this conversation and claimed that I should have been summoned as a witness. What I have set down about it is what I should have said had I been called.
The Second World War, Chapter 14. Mr. Eden at the Foreign Office. His resignation.
The Foreign Secretary has a special position in a British cabinet. He is treated with marked respect in his high and responsible office, but he usually conducts his affairs under the continuous scrutiny, if not of the whole cabinet, at least of its principal members. He is under an obligation to keep them informed. He circulates to his colleagues, as a matter of custom and routine, all his executive telegrams, the reports from our embassies abroad, the records of his interviews with foreign ambassadors or other notables. At least this has been the case during my experience of cabinet life. This supervision is, of course, especially maintained by the Prime Minister through his cabinet. No foreign secretary can do his work unless he is supported constantly by his chief. To make things go smoothly, there must not only be agreement between them on fundamentals, but a harmony of outlook, and even to some extent of temperament. This is all the more important if the Prime Minister himself devotes special attention to foreign affairs. Eden was the Foreign Secretary of Mr. Baldwin, who, apart from his main well-known desire for peace and a quiet life, took no active share in foreign policy. Mr. Chamberlain, on the other hand, sought to exercise a masterful control in many departments. He had strong views about foreign affairs, and from the beginning asserted his undoubted right to discuss them with foreign ambassadors. His assumption of the premiership, therefore, implied a delicate but perceptible change in the position of the Foreign Secretary. To this was added a profound, though at first latent, difference of spirit and opinion. The Prime Minister wished to get on good terms with the two European dictators and believed that conciliation and the avoidance of anything likely to offend them was the best method. Eden, on the other hand, had won his reputation at Geneva by rallying the nations of Europe against one dictator, and left to himself might well have carried sanctions to the verge of war, and perhaps beyond. He was a devoted adherent of the French Entente. He had just insisted upon staff conversations. He was anxious to have more intimate relations with Soviet Russia. He felt and feared the Hitler peril. He was alarmed by the weakness of our armaments and its reaction on foreign affairs. It might almost be said there was not much difference of view between him and me, except, of course, that he was in harness. It seemed, therefore, to me from the beginning that differences would be likely to arise between these two leading ministerial figures as the world situation became more acute. This inauspicious situation developed steadily during the year that Eden and Chamberlain worked together. Early in October, 1937, I was invited to a dinner at the Foreign Office for the Yugoslav Premier, Monsieur Stojadinovich. Afterwards, when we were all standing about, and I was talking to Eaton, Lord Halifax came up and said in a genial way that Goering had invited him to Germany on a sports visit, and the hope was held out that he would certainly be able to see Hitler. He said he had spoken about it to the Prime Minister, who thought it would be a very good thing, and therefore he had accepted. I had the impression that Eden was surprised and did not like it. Everything passed off pleasantly. Halifax therefore visited Germany in his capacity as a master of foxhounds. He was, in fact, bidden to Berchtesgaden and had an informal and none too ceremonious interview with the Führer. This did not go very well. One could hardly conceive two personalities less able to comprehend one another. This high church Yorkshire aristocrat and ardent peace lover, reared in all the smiling goodwill of former English life, who had taken his part in the war as a good officer, met, on the other side, the demon genius sprung from the abyss of poverty, inflamed by defeat, devoured by hatred and revenge, and convulsed by his design to make the German race masters of Europe, or maybe the world. Nothing came of all this but chatter and bewilderment. I may mention here that Ribbentrop twice tendered me an invitation to visit Herr Hitler. Long before, as colonial undersecretary and a major in the Oxfordshire Yeomanry, I had been the guest of the Kaiser at the German maneuvers in 1907 and in 1909. But now there was a different tune. Mortal quarrels were afoot, and I had my station in them. I would gladly have met Hitler with the authority of Britain behind me, but as a private individual I should have placed myself and my country at a disadvantage. If I had agreed with the dictator host, I should have misled him. If I had disagreed, he would have been offended, and I should have been accused of spoiling Anglo-German relations. Therefore I declined, or rather let lapse, both invitations. All those Englishmen who visited the German Führer in these years were embarrassed or compromised. No one was more completely misled than Mr. Lloyd George, whose rapturous accounts of his conversations make odd reading today. There is no doubt that Hitler had a power of fascinating men, and the sense of force and authority is apt to assert itself unduly upon the tourist. Unless the terms are equal, it is better to keep away. During these November days, Eden became increasingly concerned about our slow rearmament. On the 11th, he had an interview with the Prime Minister and tried to convey his misgivings. Mr. Chamberlain, after a while, refused to listen to him. He advised him to go home and take an aspirin. When Halifax returned from Berlin, he reported that Hitler had told him the colonial question was the only outstanding issue between Britain and Germany. He believed the Germans were in no hurry. There was no immediate prospect of a peace deal. Its conclusions were negative and his mood passive. In February 1938, the Foreign Secretary conceived himself to be almost isolated in the cabinet. The Prime Minister had strong support against him and his outlook. A whole band of important ministers thought the Foreign Office policy dangerous and even provocative. On the other hand, a number of the younger ministers were very ready to understand his point of view. Some of them later complained that he did not take them into his confidence. He did not, however, contemplate anything like forming a group against his leader. The troops and staff could give him no help. Indeed, they enjoined caution and dwelt upon the dangers of the situation. But the actual breach came over a new and separate issue. On the evening of January 11, 1938, Mr. Sumner Wells, the American Undersecretary of State, called upon the British ambassador in Washington. He was the bearer of a secret and confidential message from President Roosevelt to Mr. Chamberlain. The President was deeply anxious at the deterioration of the international situation and proposed to take the initiative by inviting the representatives of certain governments to Washington to discuss the underlying causes of present differences. Before taking this step, however, he wished to consult the British government on their view of such a plan and stipulated that no other government should be informed either of the nature or the existence of such a proposal. He asked that not later than January 17, he should be given a reply to his message, and intimated that only if his suggestion met with the cordial approval and wholehearted support of His Majesty's government would he then approach the governments of France, Germany, and Italy. Here went a formidable and measureless step. In forwarding this most secret message to London, the British ambassador, Sir Ronald Lindsay, commented that in his view the President's plan was a genuine effort to relax international tension, and that if His Majesty's government withheld their support, the progress that had been made in Anglo-American cooperation during the previous 2 years would be destroyed. He urged in the most earnest manner acceptance of the proposal by the British government. The Foreign Office received the Washington telegram on January the 12th, and copies were sent to the Prime Minister in the country that evening. On the following morning, he came to London, and on his instructions, a reply was sent to the President's message. Mr. Eden was at this time on a brief holiday in the south of France. Mr. Chamberlain's reply was to the effect that he appreciated the confidence of President Roosevelt in consulting him in this fashion for his proposed plan to alleviate the existing tension in Europe, but he wished to explain the position of his own efforts to reach agreement with Germany and Italy, particularly in the case of the latter. His Majesty's government would be prepared for their part, he said, if possible with the authority of the League of Nations, to recognize de jure the Italian occupation of Abyssinia. If they found that the Italian government on their side were ready to give evidence of their desire to contribute to the restoration of confidence and friendly relations. The Prime Minister mentioned these facts, the message continued, so that the President might consider whether his proposal might not cut across the British efforts. Would it not, therefore, be wiser to postpone the launching of the American plan? This reply was received by the President with some disappointment. He intimated that he would reply by letter to Mr. Chamberlain on January 17th. On the evening of January the 15th, the Foreign Secretary returned to England. He'd been urged to come back, not by his chief, who would consent to act without him, but by his devoted officials at the Foreign Office. The vigilant Alexander Cadogan awaited him upon the pier at Dover. Mr. Eden, who had worked long and hard to improve Anglo-American relations, was deeply perturbed. He immediately sent a telegram to Sir Ronald Lindsay, attempting to minimize the effects of Mr. Chamberlain's chilling answer. The President's letter reached London on the morning of January 18. In it, he agreed to postpone making his proposal, in view of the fact that the British government were contemplating direct negotiations. But he added that he was gravely concerned at the suggestion that His Majesty's government might accord recognition to the Italian position in Abyssinia. He thought that this would have a most harmful effect upon Japanese policy in the Far East and upon American public opinion. Mr. Cordell Hull, in delivering this letter to the British ambassador in Washington, expressed himself even more emphatically. He said that such a recognition would rouse a feeling of disgust, revive and multiply all fears of pulling the chestnuts out of the fire. It would be represented as a corrupt bargain, completed in Europe at the expense of interests in the Far East, in which America was intimately concerned. The President's letter was considered at a series of meetings of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Cabinet. Mr. Eden succeeded in procuring a considerable modification of the previous attitude. Most of the ministers thought he was satisfied. He did not make it clear to them that he was not. Following these discussions, two messages were sent to Washington on the evening of January the 21st. The substance of these replies was that the Prime Minister warmly welcomed the President's initiative, but was not anxious to bear any responsibility for its failure if American overtures were badly received. Mr. Chamberlain wished to point out that we should not accept in an unqualified manner the President's suggested procedure, which would clearly irritate both the dictators and Japan. Nor did His Majesty's government feel that the President had fully understood our position in regard to de jure recognition. But the second message was, in fact, an explanation of our attitude in this matter. We intended to accord such recognition only as part of a general settlement with Italy. Thus it was that President Roosevelt's proposal to use American influence for the purpose of bringing together the leading European powers to discuss the chances of a general settlement This, of course, involving, however, tentatively, the mighty power of the United States, was rebuffed by Mr. Chamberlain. This attitude defined in a decisive manner the difference of view between the British Prime Minister and his Foreign Secretary. Their disagreements were still confined to the circle of the Cabinet for a little time longer, but the split was fundamental. The comments of Mr. Chamberlain's biographer, Professor Feiling, upon this episode are not without interest. While Chamberlain, he said, feared the dictators would pay no heed, or else would use this lineup of the democracies as a pretext for a break, it was found on Eden's return that he would rather risk that calamity than the loss of American goodwill. There was the first breath of resignation, but a compromise was beaten out. Poor England, leading a free, careless life from day to day, amid endless good-tempered parliamentary babble, she followed wandering along the downward path which led to all she wanted to avoid. She was continually reassured by the leading articles of the most influential newspapers, with some honorable exceptions, and behaved as if all the world were at ease, uncalculating, and well-meaning as herself. It was plain that no resignation by the Foreign Secretary could be founded upon the rebuff administered by Mr. Chamberlain to the President's overture. Mr. Roosevelt was indeed running great risks in his own domestic politics by deliberately involving the United States in the darkening European scene. All the forces of isolationism would have been aroused if any part of these interchanges had transpired. On the other hand, no event could have been more likely to stave off or even prevent war than the arrival of the United States in the circle of European hates and fears. To Britain, it was a matter almost of life and death. No one can measure, in retrospect, its effect upon the course of events in Austria and later at Munich. We must regard its rejection, for such it was, as the loss of the last frail chance to save the world from tyranny, otherwise than by war. That Mr. Chamberlain, with his limited outlook and inexperience of the European scene, should have possessed the self-sufficiency to wave away the proffered hand stretched out across the Atlantic, leaves one, even at this date, breathless with amazement. The lack of all sense of proportion, and even of self-preservation, which this episode reveals in an upright, competent, well-meaning man, charged with the destinies of our country and all who depended upon it, is appalling. One cannot today even reconstruct the state of mind which would render such gestures possible. I have yet to unfold the story of the treatment of the Russian offers of collaboration in the advent of Munich. If only the British people could have known and realized that having neglected our defenses and sought to diminish the defenses of France, we were now disengaging ourselves one after the other from the two mighty nations whose extreme efforts were needed to save our lives and their own, history might have taken a different turn. But all seemed so easy from day to day. Let the lessons of the past be a guide. It must have been with declining confidence in the future that Mr. Eden went to Paris on January the 25th to consult with the French. Everything now turned upon the success of the approach to Italy, of which we had made such a point in our replies to the President. The French ministers impressed upon Mr. Eden the necessity of the inclusion of Spain in any general settlement with the Italians. On this he needed little convincing. On February the 10th, the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary met Count Grandi, who declared that the Italians were ready, in principle, to open the conversations. On February the 15th, the news came of the submission of the Austrian Chancellor, Schuschnigg, to the German demand for the introduction into the Austrian cabinet of the chief Nazi agent, Seyss Inquart, as Minister of the Interior and head of the Austrian police. This grave event did not avert the personal crisis between Mr. Chamberlain and Mr. Eden. On February the 18th, they saw Count Grandi again. This was the last visit they conducted together. The ambassador refused either to discuss the Italian position towards Austria or to consider the British plan for the withdrawal of volunteers, or so-called volunteers. In this case, five divisions of the regular Italian army from Spain. Grandi asked, however, for general conversations to be opened in Rome. The Prime Minister wished for these, and the Foreign Secretary to such a step. There were prolonged parleyings and cabinet meetings. Of these, the only authoritative account yet disclosed is in Mr. Chamberlain's biography. Mr. Feiling says that the Prime Minister let the cabinet see that the alternative to Eden's resignation might be his own. He quotes from some diary or private letter to which he was given access the following statement by the Prime Minister. I thought it necessary to say clearly that I could not accept any decision in the opposite sense. The cabinet, says Mr. Farley, were unanimous, though with a few reserves. We have no knowledge of how and when these statements were made during the protracted discussions. But at the issue of the conversations taking place at this stage and in these circumstances. At this, his colleagues were astonished. They were much shaken. They had not realized that the difference between the Foreign Secretary and the Prime Minister had reached breaking point. Evidently, if Mr. Eden's resignation was involved, a new question raising larger and more general issues was raised. However, they had all committed themselves on the merits of the matter in dispute. The rest of the long day was spent in efforts to induce the Foreign Secretary to change his mind. Mr. Chamberlain was impressed by the distress of the cabinet. Seeing how my colleagues had been taken aback, I proposed an adjournment until next day. But Eden saw no use in continuing a search for formulas, and by midnight on the 20th, his resignation became final. Greatly to his credit, as I see it, noted the Prime Minister, Lord Halifax was at once appointed Foreign Secretary in his place. It had, of course, become known that there were serious differences in the cabinet, though the cause was obscure. I had heard something of this, but carefully abstained from any communication with Mr. Eden. I hoped that he would not on any account resign without building up his case beforehand and giving his many friends in Parliament a chance to draw out the issues. But the government at this time was so powerful and aloof that the struggle was fought out inside the ministerial conclave, and mainly between the two men. Late in the night of February 20, a telephone message reached me as I sat in my old room at Chartwell, as I often sit now, that Eden had resigned. I must confess that my heart sank, and for a while the dark waters of despair overwhelmed me. In a long life I've had many ups and downs. During all the war, soon to come, and in its darkest times, I never had any trouble in sleeping. In the crisis of 1940, when so much responsibility lay upon me, and also at many very anxious, awkward moments in the following 5 years, I could always flop into bed and go to sleep after the day's work was done, subject, of course, to any emergency call. I slept sound and awoke refreshed, and had no feelings except appetite to grapple with whatever the morning's boxes might bring. But now, on this night, February 20, 1938, and on this occasion only, sleep deserted me. From midnight till dawn, I lay in my bed, consumed by emotions of sorrow and fear. There seemed one strong young figure standing up against long, dismal, drawling tides of drift and surrender, of wrong measurements and feeble impulses. My conduct of affairs would have been different from his in various ways, but he seemed to me at this moment to embody the life hope of the British nation, the grand old British race that had done so much for men and yet had some more to give. Now he was gone. I watched the daylight slowly creep in through the windows and saw before me in mental gaze the vision of death.
Here is Winston Churchill, politician and painter, speaking at the Royal Academy banquet, the 30th of April, 1938.
No large organization can long continue without a strong element of authority and respect for authority. There must be in any healthy, effective body, here perhaps I trespass on delicate ground in the presence of so many ministers of the Crown, but there must be in any effective body
I'll risk it. A sense of collective security. It is a broad question whether any measure of regimentation is compatible with art. Yeah, in another country, which certainly shall be nameless, an artist would be sent to a concentration camp for putting too much green in his sky or too much blue in his trees. Even more grievous penalties would be reserved for it if he should be suspected of preferring vermilion to madder brown. We should all agree that such rigor was excessive over here. But surely...
Munich Winter, Chapter 18 of the Second World War.
We must really not waste time after this long debate upon the difference between the positions reached at Berchtesgaden, at Godesberg, and at Munich. No one has been a more resolute and uncompromising struggler for peace than the Prime Minister. Everyone knows that. Never has there been such an intense and undaunted determination to maintain and secure peace. Nevertheless, I am not quite clear why there was so much danger of Great Britain or France being involved in a war with Germany at this juncture, if in fact they were ready all along to sacrifice Czechoslovakia. The terms which the Prime Minister brought back with him could easily have been agreed, I believe, through the ordinary diplomatic channels at any time during the summer. And I will say this, that I believe the Czechs, left to themselves, and told they were going to get no help from the Western powers, would have been able to make better terms than they have got after all this tremendous perturbation. They could hardly have had worse. All is over. Silent, mournful, abandoned, broken. Czechoslovakia recedes into the darkness. She has suffered in every respect by her association with France, under whose guidance and policy she has been actuated for so long. I find unendurable the sense of our country falling into the power, into the orbit and influence of Nazi Germany, and of our existence becoming dependent upon their goodwill or pressure. It is to prevent that, and that I have tried my best to urge the maintenance of every bulwark of defense. First, the timely creation of an air force superior to anything within striking distance of our shores. Secondly, the gathering together of the collective strength of many nations. And thirdly, the making of alliances and military conventions, all within the covenant, in order to gather together forces, at any rate, to restrain the onward movement of this power. It has all been in vain. Every position has been successively undermined and abandoned on specious and plausible excuses. I do not grudge our loyal, brave people, who were ready to do their duty no matter what the cost, who never flinched under the strain of last week, the natural spontaneous outburst of joy and relief when they learned that the hard ordeal would no longer be required of them at the moment. But they should know the truth. They should know that there has been gross neglect and deficiency in our defenses. They should know that we have sustained a defeat without a war, the consequence into which will travel far with us along the road. They should know that we have passed an awful milestone in our history, when the whole equilibrium of Europe has been deranged, and that the terrible words have for the time being been pronounced against the Western democracies. Thou art weighed in the balance and found wanting, and do not suppose that this is the end. This is only the beginning of the reckoning. This is only the first sip, the first foretaste of a bitter cup, which will be proffered to us year by year, unless by a supreme recovery of moral health and martial vigor we rise again and take our stand for freedom as in the olden time.
On the 16th of October, 1938, Mr. Winston Churchill broadcast from London to the United States.
Alexander the Great remarked that the peoples of Asia were slaves because they had not learned to pronounce the word no. Let that not be the epitaph of the English-speaking people, or of parliamentary democracy, or of France, or of the many surviving liberal states of Europe. There, in one single word, is the resolve which the forces of freedom and progress, of tolerance and goodwill, there is the resolve which they should take. It is not in the power of one nation, however formidably armed. Still less is it in the power of a small group of men, violent, ruthless men, who have always, however, to cast their eyes back over their shoulders. It is not in their power to cramp and fetter the forward march of human destiny. The preponderant world forces are upon our side. They have but to be combined to be obeyed. We must arm. Britain must arm. America must arm. We shall no doubt arm. Britain, casting away the habits of centuries, will decree national service for her citizens. But arms, instrumentalities, as President Wilson called them, are not sufficient by themselves. We must add to them the power of ideas. People say, many people, we ought not to allow ourselves to be drawn into a theoretical antagonism between Nazism and democracy. But the antagonism is here, now. You see these dictators on their pedestal, surrounded by the bayonets of their soldiers and the truncheons of their police. They are afraid of words and thoughts. Words spoken abroad. Thoughts stirring at home. All the more powerful because forbidden. These terrify them. A little mouse, a little tiny mouse of thought appears in the room. And even the mightiest potentates are thrown into panic. They make frantic efforts to bar out thoughts and words. They're afraid of the workings of the human mind. A state of society where men may not speak their minds, where children denounce their parents to the police, where a businessman or small shopkeeper ruins his competitor by telling tales about his private opinion. Such a state of society cannot long endure if it is brought continually in contact with the healthy outside world. The light of civilized progress, with its tolerances and cooperation, with its dignities and joys, has often been blotted out. But I hold the belief that we have now at last got far enough ahead of barbarism to control it and to avert it, if only we realize what is afoot and make up our minds in good time. Is this a call to war? Does anyone pretend that preparations for resistance against aggression amount to the unleashing of war? I declare it to be the sole guarantee of peace, the finest and the surest prospect of peace.
In his memoirs of the Second World War, Chapter 20, Churchill speaks of the Soviet enigma.
The dismissal of Litvinov marked the end of an epoch. It registered the abandonment by the Kremlin of all faith in a security pact with the Western powers, and in the possibility of organizing an Eastern Front against Germany. The German press comments at the time, though not necessarily accurate, are interesting. On May the 7th, the Frankfurter Zeitung was already sufficiently informed to state that Litvinov's resignation was extremely serious for the future of Anglo-French encirclement. and its probable meaning was that those in Russia concerned with the military burden resulting from it had called a halt to Litvinov. All this was true. But for an interval it was necessary that a veil of deceit should cover the immense transaction, and that even up to the latest moment the Soviet attitude should remain in doubt. Russia must have a move both ways. How else could she drive her bargain with the hated and dreaded Hitler? The Jew Litvinov was gone, and Hitler's dominant prejudice placated. From that moment, the German government ceased to define its foreign policy as anti-Bolshevism and turned its abuse upon the pluto-democracies. Newspaper articles assured the Soviets that the German Lebensraum did not encroach on Russian territory, that indeed it stopped short of the Russian frontier at all points. Consequently, there could be no cause of conflict between Russia and Germany unless the Soviets entered into encirclement engagements with England and France. The German ambassador, Count Schulenburg, who had been summoned to Berlin for lengthy consultations, returned to Moscow with an offer of an advantageous goods credit on a long-term basis. The movement on both sides was towards a compact. This violent and unnatural reversal of Russian policy was a transmogrification of which only totalitarian states are capable. The figure whom Stalin had now moved to the pulpit of Soviet foreign policy deserves some description, not available to the British and French governments at the time. Vyacheslav Molotov was a man of outstanding ability and cold-blooded ruthlessness. He had survived the fearful hazards and ordeals to which all the Bolshevik leaders had been subjected in the years of triumphant revolution. He had lived and thrived in a society where ever-varying intrigue was accompanied by the constant menace of personal liquidation. His cannonball head, black moustache, and comprehending eyes, his slab face, his verbal adroitness and imperturbable demeanor were appropriate manifestations of his qualities and skill. He was above all men fitted to be the agent and instrument of the policy of an incalculable machine. I've only met him on equal terms, in parlies where sometimes a strain of humor appeared, or at banquets where he genially proposed a long succession of conventional and meaningless toasts. I have never seen a human being who more perfectly represented the modern conception of a robot. And yet, with all this, there was an apparently reasonable and keenly polished diplomatist. What he was to his inferiors, I cannot tell. What he was to the Japanese ambassador during the years when, after the Tehran conference, Stalin had promised to attack Japan once the German army was beaten, can be deduced from his recorded conversations. One delicate, searching, awkward interview after another was conducted with perfect poise, impenetrable purpose, and bland official correctitude. Never a chink was opened, never a needless jar was made. His smile of Siberian winter, his carefully measured and often wise words, his affable demeanor combined to make him the perfect agent of Soviet policy in a deadly world. Correspondence with him upon disputed matters was always useless and insult. Only once did I seem to get a natural human reaction. This was in the spring of 1942, when he alighted in England on his way back from the United States. We had signed the Anglo-Soviet Treaty, and he was about to make his dangerous flight home. At the garden gate of Downing Street, which we used for secrecy, I gripped his arm, and we looked each other in the face. Suddenly he appeared deeply moved. Inside the image there appeared the man. He responded with an equal pressure. Silently we wrung each other's hands. But then we were all together, and it was life or death for the lot. Certainly, in Molotov, the Soviet machine had found a capable and in many ways a characteristic representative, always the faithful party man and communist disciple. How glad I am at the end of my life not to have had to endure the stresses which he had suffered. Better never be born. In the conduct of foreign affairs, Mazarin, Talleyrand, Metternich would welcome him to their company if there be another world to which Bolsheviks allow themselves to go.
Chapter 22 from Winston Churchill's memoirs. War.
Poland was attacked by Germany at dawn on September the 1st. The mobilization of all our forces was ordered during the morning. The Prime Minister asked me to visit him in the afternoon at Downing Street. He told me he saw no hope of averting a war with Germany, and that he proposed to form a small war cabinet of ministers without departments to conduct it. He invited me to become a member of the war cabinet. I agreed to his proposal without comment, and on this basis we had a long talk on men and measures. I learned later that a British ultimatum had been given to Germany at 9:30 p.m. on September the 1st, and that this had been followed by a second and final ultimatum at 9 o'clock on September the 3rd. The Prime Minister's broadcast informed us that we were already at war, and he had scarcely ceased speaking when a strange, prolonged, wailing noise, afterwards to become familiar, broke upon the air. My wife came into the room, braced by the crisis, and commented favorably upon the German promptitude and precision. And we went up to the flat top of the house to see what was going on. Around us on every side, in the clear, cool September light, rose the roofs and spires of London. Above them were already slowly rising 30 or 40 cylindrical balloons. We gave the government a good mark for this evident sign of preparation, and at a quarter of an hour's notice, which we had been led to expect we should receive, was now running out. We made our way to the shelter assigned to us, armed with a bottle of brandy and other appropriate medical comforts. Our shelter was 100 yards down the street and consisted merely of an open basement, not even sandbagged, in which the tenants of half a dozen flats were already assembled. Everyone was cheerful and jocular, as is the English manner when about to encounter the unknown. As I gazed from the doorway along the empty street and at the crowded room below, my imagination drew pictures of ruin and carnage and vast explosions shaking the ground, of buildings clattering down in dust and rubble, of fire brigades and ambulances scurrying through the smoke beneath the drone of hostile aeroplanes. For had we not all been taught how terrible air raids would be, the Air Ministry had, in natural self-importance, greatly exaggerated their power. The pacifists had sought to play on public fears, and those of us who had so long pressed for preparation and a superior air force, while not accepting the most lurid forecasts, had been content they should act as a spur. I knew that the government were prepared in the first days of the war with over 250,000 beds for air raid casualties. Here, at least, there had been no underestimation. Now we should see what were the facts. After about 10 minutes had passed, the wailing broke out again. I was myself not sure that this was not a reiteration of the previous warning. But a man came running along the street, shouting, "All clear," and we dispersed to our dwellings and went about our business. Mine was to go to the House of Commons, which duly met at noon, with its unhurried procedure and brief, stately prayers. There I received a note from the Prime Minister asking me to come to his room as soon as the debate died down. Later in the morning, Mr. Chamberlain told me that he was able to meet my views about the average age of the War Cabinet by bringing in the 3 service ministers, and that this would reduce the average age to less than 60. This, he said, made it possible for him to offer me the Admiralty, as well as a seat in the War Cabinet. Had the Prime Minister in the first instance given me the choice between the War Cabinet and the Admiralty, I should, of course, have chosen the Admiralty. Now I was to have both. I therefore sent word to the Admiralty that I would take charge forthwith and arrive at 6 o'clock On this, the board were kind enough to signal to the fleet, Winston is back. So it was that I came back again to the room I'd quitted in pain and sorrow almost exactly a quarter of a century before, when Lord Fisher's resignation had led to my removal from my post as First Lord and ruined irretrievably, as it proved, the important conception of forcing the Dardanelles. And still mortal peril threatened us at the hands of the same nation. Once again, defense of the rights of a weak state, outraged and invaded by unprovoked aggression, forced us to draw the sword. Once again, we must fight for life and honor against all the might and fury of the valiant, disciplined, and ruthless German race. Once again, so be it.
From the BBC in London, Winston Churchill speaks on The First Month of War, October 1st, 1939, a world broadcast.
The British Empire and the French Republic have been at war with Nazi Germany for a month tonight. We have not yet come at all to the severity of fighting, which is to be expected. But three important things have happened. First, Poland has been again overrun by two of the great powers which held her in bondage for 150 years, but were unable to quench the spirit of the Polish nation. The heroic defense of Warsaw shows that the soul of Poland is indestructible and that she will rise again like a rock which may for a spell be submerged by a tidal wave, but which remains a rock. What is the second event of this first month? It is, of course, the assertion of the power of Russia. Russia has pursued a cold policy of self-interest. We could have wished that the Russian armies should be standing on their present line as the friends and allies of Poland instead of as invaders. But that the Russian armies should stand on this line was clearly necessary for the safety of Russia against the Nazi menace. At any rate, the line is there, and an eastern front has been created which Nazi Germany does not dare assail. What is the third event? Here I speak as First Lord of the Admiralty, with especial caution. It would seem that the U-boat attack upon the life of the British Isles has not so far proved successful. It is true that when they sprang out upon us and we were going about our ordinary business with 2,000 ships in constant movement every day upon the seas, they managed to do some serious damage. But the Royal Navy had immediately attacked the U-boats and is hunting them night and day. I will not say without mercy, because God forbid we should ever part company with that. But at any rate, with zeal, and not altogether without relish. And it looks tonight very much as if it is the U-boats who are feeling the weather, and not the Royal Navy or the worldwide commerce of Britain. A week has passed.
Mr. Churchill then went on.
Over here. Directions have been given by the government to prepare for a war of at least 3 years. That does not mean that victory may not be gained in a shorter time. How soon it will be gained depends upon how long Herr Hitler and his group of wicked men, whose hands are stained with blood and soiled with corruption, can keep their grip upon the docile, unhappy German people. It was for Hitler to say when the war would begin.
But it is not for him, or for his successor, to say when it will end. It began when he wanted it. And it will end only when we are convinced that he has had enough. We may remember the words of old John Bright after the American Civil War was over, when he said to an audience of English working folk, "At last, after the smoke of the battlefield had cleared away, the horrid shape which had cast its shadow over the whole continent had vanished and was gone forever."